All right. Good afternoon. We are here for argument today on case number 85527, National Football League and Roger Goodell versus John Gruden. Is everybody ready to proceed? Okay, great. And help me with how you pronounce your last name.
Thank you, Chief Justice Kadish Cannon Shanmugam. For the NFL appellants.
Okay, great. So you have 15 minutes of argument for your side. Would you like to reserve any time for rebuttal?
I would, with the court's leave, 3 minutes, please.
And so what will happen is it still counts down from the full 15 minutes. When it gets down to three, the yellow light will come on. There'll be a tone that you'll hear, but the clock keeps running as long as you're still standing there.
Great. Thank you very much.
Go ahead.
May it please the court. In this case, former Raiders coach John Gruden brings unsubstantiated claims against the NFL and its commissioner, claiming that they are somehow responsible for his resignation after the publication of racist, homophobic, and misogynistic emails that he wrote and broadly circulated, emails that are too vile to read out in open court. But when Gruden entered into his contract with the Raiders, the richest coaching contract in NFL history, he agreed to two broad arbitration provisions that cover all disputes arising out of his employment agreement or involving conduct detrimental to the league. The district court erred by refusing to hold Gruden to either of those provisions and to send his claims to arbitration. Now, in particular, the arbitration provision in the NFL Constitution, which was unambiguously incorporated into Gruden's employment agreement, covers the claims in this dispute. And it is neither procedurally nor substantively unconscionable. Gruden's contrary arguments, embodied in a draft order that the district court simply adopted wholesale, lack merit, and they ignore both the Gruden represented that he had read the NFL Constitution, and that Gruden was the very definition of a sophisticated party. Having settled his claims with the Raiders for an undisclosed sum, Gruden now seeks an additional payday for his reprehensible conduct. Settled law requires that his claims be sent to arbitration, and the district court's order should therefore be reversed. Now, with the court's leave, I'd like to start with the NFL Constitution, because I think that the easiest route to a reversal is to say that that arbitration provision applies here. Now, to begin with, Gruden does not seriously dispute that his employment agreement with the Raiders expressly incorporated the terms of the NFL Constitution, and you'll see that at pages 48 to 49 of Appellant's Appendix. Indeed, what is more, in the agreement, Gruden affirmatively represented that he had read and understood the Constitution.
In that provision of the Constitution, though, counsel, it doesn't reference disputes with the commissioner himself.
So Article 8.3e, and this is at page 85 of the appendix, contains no limitation concerning the parties at all. So the relevant language is that the commissioner has jurisdiction to arbitrate any dispute involving any employees of members of the NFL that in the opinion of the commissioner constitutes conduct detrimental. So I will acknowledge that one difference between the provision in the NFL Constitution and the provision that is actually in the employment agreement itself is that the latter provision does contain that limitation. That's why we need the doctrine of equitable estoppel with regard to that provision. Here, by contrast, we don't need that because there is no limitation in the provision itself.
But by its terms, 8.3e does not reference the commissioner except as the arbitrator or the NFL. It's quite specific about members of the league, any players or employees of members of the league, or any combination thereof. But missing from that list is the commissioner and the NFL.
So, again, our view is the relevant language is any dispute involving any employees. And so what we believe that that means, and I don't hear my friend Mr. Hosmer-Henner to dispute this, is that by its terms, once you have, as one of the parties to the dispute, an employee, the provision itself is triggered. Again,
so,
there is
so
no...
would this apply if there were a contentious divorce that involves scandalous allegations involving things that occurred while a player was playing for the league?
So it would require a determination by the commissioner that the conduct at issue be conduct detrimental to the best interests of the NFL or professional football. Now, as your honor may be aware, there will be circumstances in the disciplinary context where there will be conduct detrimental determinations based on the conduct of players off the field as well as on the field. But that is really the limitation here, is that it must be conduct detrimental to the best interests of the NFL. Now, the other thing,
as a practical matter, how does it work for the commissioner to be a party to the dispute and the arbiter of the dispute?
So that goes, Justice Bell, to the question of substantive unconscionability. And I would say two things about that. First, that this court need not reach that question once it concludes that the provision in the NFL Constitution applies, if it agrees with us that there is no procedural unconscionability. And here I think the case on procedural unconscionability is quite clear. I'm certainly aware of no case in Nevada where a $100 million employment agreement negotiated by an expert agent has been held to be procedurally unconscionable.
Well, but counsel, what about due process? I mean, to have a dispute with somebody who's the one deciding the dispute seems like there might be a problem there.
Yes. So if the court were to reach the issue of substantive unconscionability, I would make 2 points about the possibility that the commissioner would be the arbitrator. First, that in the context of sports leagues, there is substantial authority for the proposition that it is okay for the commissioner to act as arbitrator, even where the commissioner is reviewing his own handiwork in the disciplinary context. Mr. Hosmer-Henner, in his reply brief, doesn't address any of that authority. We cite decisions from the Second Circuit, the Eighth Circuit, and elsewhere. But I think, Chief Justice Kadish, my second point would be that under this agreement and under the dispute resolution procedures, which Mr. Gruden himself attached to the filings below, the commissioner has the authority to designate someone else to serve as the arbitrator. So if the commissioner decided to be the arbitrator here, and I would expect that he wouldn't under these circumstances, but if he were to make the decision that he would designate himself, that he would proceed as the arbitrator, of course he would potentially be exposing himself to a challenge if he were to issue an arbitral award that he was acting out of bias. That's one of the familiar bases for challenging an arbitral award. But our submission is that for purposes of substantive unconscionability, that's kind of an unripe consideration here, because the commissioner could designate someone else to serve as the arbitrator. If you look at the cases we rely on, in many of those cases, the commissioner, in fact, has done so. And that would alleviate any concern about bias. Now, again, there's no independent constitutional challenge here. The only relevance of that in Mr. Hosmer-Henner's brief is to substantive unconscionability. And again, the court only gets to that if it concludes that there is procedural unconscionability here. So we would submit that the straightest line to a reversal here is to say two things. First, that the NFL Constitution arbitration provision applies. And one last thing I would say to Justice Pickering on the issue of kind of an outlandish hypothetical, something that has nothing to do with employment, is that it is certainly true that there is one other significant limitation, and that is, you know, the limitation that when you're talking about a situation in which the contract has been terminated, the claims at issue have to have their roots in the contractual relationship. We are in agreement with Mr. Gruden that that is a fundamental principle of California law. Now, here, of course, you know, the dispute itself involves the alleged infringement of rights under the contract. Some of the conduct at issue, the alleged leaking of the emails, obviously took place during the contractual relationship. So this is an easy case with regard to that, relatively
generous.
Could
Mr. Gruden have moved to compel arbitration against the NFL and the commissioner under this clause as worded?
This clause as worded is bilateral in that regard. So again, any dispute involving any employee of a member of the NFL, if he wanted to compel arbitration, he is a party to that dispute. And so by its terms, that provision would be triggered. Now, it would have to be conduct detrimental to the best interests of the NFL. And if the commissioner made a determination that the conduct at issue did not qualify, then of course that requirement would not be satisfied. But, and there are other subparts, as you will be aware, of Article 8.3 that don't contain that limitation.
But I mean, so, you could read Article 8, read as a whole, to say it reaches disciplinary matters and that 8.3e is a catch-all, but that it does not include the commissioner and the NFL, because while it lists everybody else, it doesn't list them.
So there is no such limitation on the face of Article 8.3 to disciplinary proceedings. And so this would work the same way. And of course, if you look at some of the other subparts, you know, let's say you have a dispute between two teams, that would not typically involve disciplinary proceedings at all. And yet that would be triggered potentially by other parts of 8.3 and also potentially by 8.3E as a catch-all.
Well, but 8.3A would seem to capture that, any dispute involving two or more members of the league.
Correct. My point is simply that Article 8.3 as a whole is not limited to the context of disciplinary proceedings, and 8.3E does not contain that limitation either. Now, obviously, we also rely on the provision in the employment agreement, and while that provision by its terms does contain the limitation to disputes between, in this case, Gruden and the Raiders, the whole point of the doctrine of equitable estoppel is that there are circumstances in which third parties are able, notwithstanding textual limitations, to invoke arbitration provisions where there is a close relationship between the claims and the underlying contract. And our fundamental submission on that is that when you look at the California cases, cases like Boucher, those are cases where when you have claims that presuppose the existence and the validity of a contract, as was the case in Boucher, and in addition, whereas here, the contract is concededly the primary source of the damages.
But in Boucher, both the employer and the successor to the employer were co-defendants on the claim, right?
That is correct. But I think that Boucher's reasoning was a sort of claim-by-claim analysis. And in Boucher, as in this case, you had claims for intentional interference with an existing contract and prospective contractual relations. And in addition, equitable estoppel applies where the signatory alleges substantially interdependent and concerted misconduct. And we think that here, too, that is the case. I do want to emphasize.
But there wasn't the breach of the employment contract itself that's being asserted, right?
No, and of course, you would rarely, it's hard to imagine a situation in which that would be true where you have a third party. But Justice Bell, I think what I would say is
that's virtually every California case on where they've found equitable estoppel, right? There's a third party that's tied to a contract where there's a breach of contract and a claim against a third party.
It is certainly true that in Boucher, you were dealing with a defendant who was in some sense a successor. But again, I think when you look at the claims themselves, they were claims like an intentional interference claim, elements of which are the existence and validity of a contract. And one other thing I would say, to see that my time is rapidly expiring, Justice Bell, is that in some sense, this is a very artificial case. Because but for the fact that for whatever reason, the Raiders settled out of this case and paid Coach Gruden an undisclosed sum, this would be a case where we would be operating alongside the Raiders. And to the extent that Chief Justice Kadish, you're troubled by the fact that this happens to be a case where the commissioner is a party and is the potential arbitrator, I would say that there is no meat on the bones of the allegations that the commissioner was somehow involved in this conduct. It is telling that my friends on the other side are now attempting to supplement the record with articles from ESPN to buttress allegations in the complaint that are completely threadbare. And I would respectfully submit that that creates the inference that this is artful pleading in order to try to create an unconscionability problem with the provision, which would obviously not exist, but for the fact that Commissioner Goodell was named as one of the parties. And I see that my time is slipping away, so with the court's leave, I would reserve the balance of my time. Thank you.
Counsel.
Chief Justice, and may it please the court, Adam Hausmeiner of McDonald Carano on behalf of Respondent John Gruden. There is not a presumption in favor of arbitration when there is not a valid and enforceable contract. Appellants asked this court to reverse Judge Off on the basis that there was a buried paragraph in a 450-page document that respondent never saw, couldn't negotiate, and had no opportunity to modify, while the NFL reserved the unilateral ability to change that NFL constitution.
Did Mr. Gruden not have counsel representing him when he agreed to the contract?
To my knowledge, he did not, Your Honor.
He did not. He negotiated this contract with the Raiders without counsel review it.
Your Honor, there's nothing in the record indicating that he had counsel present when he signed it or that it was explained to him. He had his agent with him, and that's the only piece of evidence in the record. These contracts are negotiated in a matter of hours. And what's important here is that that's a factual finding that the district court made that appellants have not been able to challenge. And that is that He was never provided a copy of the NFL Constitution, and nothing in the record establishes that.
But he represents in the contract that he read it.
He does, and under California law, that mere representation is insufficient, even if the party represents that they've read the employee handbook or that they read the NFL Constitution. That doesn't show that the lack of an actual opportunity to read those terms, especially when there's no indication that that 450-page document contained an arbitration clause that would affect his substantive rights, that he should have been reading that contract and been aware of it. This is a very lengthy document that is not relevant to Coach Gruden on a day-to-day basis, and that the undisputed testimony below indicates that he didn't receive. But even if he had received it, or some version of the contract, what the NFL parties failed to do was meet the burden to show that the document they introduced was the document that John Gruden was provided or that was in effect at the time that he signed his agreement. The only evidence in the record is a generic statement from an NFL attorney saying that attached as Exhibit 3 to the motion is a true and correct copy of the Constitution and bylaws of the NFL. They stretched that to mean that that Constitution was in effect at the time of this employment agreement. They easily could have put in that submission into the declaration. But just as in the Flores...
Counsel, are you familiar with our case in the regarding Uber and Airbnb, where when you download an app, you've agreed to an arbitration provision, and we have found those enforceable?
Extremely so, Your Honor. And in those cases, even the browser wrap and the click wrap type cases, that arbitration clause still has to be available to the individual. So the Blizzard case is one of the cases that was cited from California. And in that case, even if it's the bare minimum where you're scrolling through a browser wrap, it still has to be available to you.
Right.
This document was not. It was not provided to him at the time. And there's a difference here.
That's the difference between not provided to him and not available.
Well, the difference here, Your Honor, is that this could have been available, and they make the speculation that Coach Gruden could have easily requested that from the Raiders. Possibly could have, but it's their burden to show that this document was the one in existence at the time he signed it. In the Flores decision, you had an equally kind of concerning situation where they introduced a version of the document that wasn't signed. And the Southern District of New York said, you failed to meet your burden at the first stage. All you had to do was to show the executed version. They ultimately introduced that upon reconsideration. The court said it's too late. And that's what we have here. It's simply too late for them to introduce the testimony that they said that their witness would testify to. So even if he reviewed some version of the contract, that doesn't mean he reviewed the version and that this version was in effect at the time he signed the agreement. The other factual issue that's dispositive here is that there's no evidence in the record that Commissioner Goodell has issued an opinion that conduct detrimental, that this dispute involves conduct detrimental to the league. This is not a dispute and not an arbitration clause where the dispute is arbitrable if it involves conduct detrimental. That is not what Section 8.3E says. Section 8.3E only covers disputes where it is the opinion of the commissioner that the conduct is detrimental. If this is a situation where a substitute arbitrator is provided or the commissioner delegates it to another arbitrator, in the event that happens, that subsequent arbitrator doesn't decide the scope of the arbitration clause in the event that there is a over the issue of whether the conduct is detrimental to the league. That arbitrator is limited to the decision of whether it is the opinion of the commissioner that the conduct is detrimental to the league. That clause has never been enforced in a situation like this, and nor can it be enforced because it's wholly illusory and one-sided. It would allow, in response to some of your hypotheticals, the commissioner to determine that a private divorce proceeding involved conduct detrimental and thus was referred to arbitration, that a sexual harassment charge against a member of the league involved conduct detrimental, and without any purchase, any ability on the other side to buy into that proceeding or to have awareness in advance that that was going to be subject to arbitration, decide in their unilateral and unfettered discretion that the conduct is detrimental to the league and therefore refer to arbitration.
Can you talk about the language of the clause itself? Let's assume for a moment, and I realize it's contrary to your position today, if we assume for a moment that Section 8.3E of the NFL Constitution is in effect, does the language itself apply to this dispute? Like if your client were bound by it, let's assume for a moment he's bound by it.
If he was bound by that particular language, the answer is no. because there is not an opinion of the commissioner that says this conduct is detrimental. And one of the arguments they make is that it's possible for the...
Let's pause. I want to pursue what Justice Kadish is getting at, which is, let's assume that he was delivered a copy of the Constitution at time of signing, and further, that we will equate the filing of the motion to compel by the commissioner and NFL as an ipso facto determination that what's involved here is conduct detrimental. So we clear both those two hurdles. Does, by its language, does 8.3e apply? Why or why not?
One, because it only applies to current members of the league, and we don't think that the NFL Constitution should apply to former members indefinitely in perpetuity. Number two, it doesn't apply because there has been no factual predicate that the commissioner has issued an opinion that this is conduct detrimental. How it's supposed to work, Your Honor, is a situation where there is some notice and hearing, some amount of due process, and in the course of those internal proceedings, the commissioner issues an opinion or a fine saying that this particular conduct is conduct detrimental to the league, and I assess a fine of a certain amount. Absent that due process, absent that notice of a hearing, there's no factual predicate on which we could pursue an arbitration, given that it only applies to the opinion of the commissioner.
But if the commissioner had made such a finding that either the commissioner's conduct in allegedly leaking the emails or Gruden's comment in writing them, one or the other, both constituted conduct detrimental, would there be any impediment to this proceeding in arbitration?
If that finding had been made by the commissioner in accordance with due process and in accordance with a notice of a hearing, then it would be within the scope of that clause. We still believe that that would be an illusory clause and that the NFL Constitution would not be an appropriate contractual obligation for Coach Gruden because he didn't execute it. He's not a party to it. And as the Southern District of New York found in Flores, that contract's illusory because it can be modified in the sole discretion of the commissioner and the
NFL. But the contract that was not enforced in Flores was equivalent to the Raiders contract here, and it had not been approved by the commissioner as is required for that contract to take effect. That's different from the incorporation by reference of this provision. And in fact, they deemed this provision incorporated in the other properly executed contracts, right?
One of the contracts in Flores was decided on a basis. The other one, they found the NFL Constitution and this particular provision had not been validly incorporated because it was an illusory contract, because the NFL parties retained the unfettered discretion to modify the NFL Constitution. And on that basis, and in the Graham and the Bacani decision that we cite in our briefs as well, when there is nothing exchanged, when a party gets nothing from the briefing, then that contract is illusory, and the party cannot enforce it like the NFL cannot enforce it.
And that was under Massachusetts law or Florida law or something?
That was under Massachusetts law in the Flores decision. And what we cited are the two California cases, Graham and Bacani, illustrating the same principle. That especially whereas here, where there's no obligation upon the NFL, as it's not a contracting party under the NFL Constitution, doesn't have those same exchange of bilateral promises with John Gruden in the NFL Constitution, they're not a counterparty. That contract would be illusory and would lack the modicum of bilaterality that's required for any arbitration agreement. And that's specifically important here.
But that's for substantive unconscionability. And he makes the point there's no procedural unconscionability here.
And we disagree with that, Your Honor, because one of their own arguments is that every coach in the NFL has to accept the NFL Constitution in order to coach in the league. That, at a minimum, would establish the adhesiveness of the contract that would be sufficient under Armendariz and the other California decisions to establish the bare minimum procedural unconscionability. Moreover, where a much larger contract is incorporated by reference.
Every contract of adhesion isn't automatically unconscionable, right? That's not your position today, is
it? Our position is not that every contract of adhesion is unconscionable. Our contract is that where there is an issue with the contract of adhesion with unequal bargaining power and where one party reserves a take it or leave it type contract.
How is there unequal bargaining power?
Coach Gruden had no opportunity to negotiate the NFL Constitution. He couldn't request a modification of it. He had to comply with it in order to get the job that he has trained his entire life for. That is his career. And in order to perform his career and accept a job in the National Football League, he had to accept the NFL Constitution unmodified with no changes whatsoever.
Or he could have worked for ESPN, apparently.
Or he could have worked in a different profession. But under California law, working in a different profession under the Amway cases that we've cited, that's not sufficient to find that someone, that a contract isn't unconscionable. And the Amway cases are especially instructive because there, the contract and the arbitration provision provided that the parties had to choose a specifically trained arbitrator from Amway. And Amway had trained these arbitrators. They were through JAMS, but they were trained by the company itself. Here, it's much, much worse than that because Coach Gruden is required to arbitrate in front of the very parties that he is suing. They are the defendants in this action. And this idea of that they're conclusory threadbare allegations has already been tested by fire in the district court, and we've prevailed, showing that those allegations are more than sufficient under Nevada's notice pleading. We supplemented only to provide additional background, not because there was any defect, and that also is not on appeal, as the district court's decision found conclusively that every one of our claims survived. I want to quickly talk about equitable estoppel, because the equitable estoppel doctrine has two steps. One is that when there's the facts and circumstances have to be intertwined, and there has to be some fundamental fairness for why a party is attempting to argue for some benefits and some terms of the contract, but then deny the other portion of the contract related to the arbitration. That's not the case here. In Boucher, the claims involved a breach of contract, failure to pay wages, and were against two essentially joint employers. They didn't specifically analyze a tortious interference claim. Gruden's claims do not rely upon any term of the contract. There's not any provision that he's attempting to enforce against the Raiders, against the appellants here, or against any other party.
Well, but the dominant prayer for damages is predicated on his $100 million contract with the Raiders. So it is intertwined, akin to Boucher, I think.
I would disagree because it's a function of damages rather than a fact of his claims.
And he's also, isn't he alleging also negligence in the commissioner's supervision of the people who did the investigation that resulted in the leaks?
That's correct, and that's not intertwined with his employment contract with the Raiders. In fact, it has nothing to do with them, and it's entirely separate and distinguishable. What Boucher talks about is when, and the other cases, the Forever 21 case as well, talk about situations where a party is attempting to enforce the fundamental aspects of their contract, but in the guise of a statutory claim. So a failure to pay wages or some statutory violation of an employment law. Not here, where the Raiders could not have worked together with the NFL parties. There's no allegation that they did, and the claims are entirely separate and distinct. We are not bringing a claim for wrongful termination. We are bringing claims for tortious interference from the external actions that the NFL parties took, the leaking of the emails and the pressuring of the Raiders, which is a separate and distinct action from the wrongful termination of the contract by the Raiders. That organization was as much a victim as Coach Gruden was here because they received the unlawful influence and pressure from the NFL parties rather than being a co-conspirator, someone that we could have possibly named for the same conduct. But on equitable estoppel, the most important thing is the second step, which is even if you are equitably allowed to enforce and invoke the contract, it still has to match the terms of the contract and the scope of the arbitration clause inside that contract. Appellants haven't provided a single authority where a party has been able to expand the scope of an arbitration clause beyond what the parties agreed to, because that would allow them to, that would force a party to contract and arbitrate a dispute that they didn't agree to arbitrate within that specific arbitration clause with the other party. This clause was limited solely to disputes between the Raiders and Gruden, and the NFL parties cannot expand that in their own self-interest. Unless there are any other questions.
Nope.
Thank you very much.
Thanks, counsel.
May it please the court, Chief Justice Kadish and Justice Pickering, both of you asked Mr. Hosmer-Henner whether he was arguing that there is any limitation that would apply here in Article 8.3E. And he conspicuously did not take that invitation and suggest that there was. And I think that that was for good reason. When you look at the language of 8.3E, all that is required is that one of the parties be an employee. The provision itself, of course, refers to the league. And all of this, of course, has to be interpreted against the backdrop of the presumption in favor of arbitration, which would, of course, resolve any doubts about the provision's scope. Mr. Hosmer-Henner instead focuses on the validity of the incorporation. With all due respect, this suggestion that Coach Gruden should not be held to the terms of the NFL Constitution is disingenuous. If you look at his own declaration at page 575 of the appendix, he does not walk back the contractual representation that he had read and understood the terms of the Constitution. And there is no requirement that the NFL affirmatively provide a copy of the Constitution. Justice Pickering, as you pointed out, the legal standard is whether the incorporated document was known or easily available. And Mr. Gruden himself argued to the district court that the Constitution was readily available on the internet. And Gruden was a longtime NFL coach who is presumably very familiar with all of the rules of the game, which are contained in the Constitution and bylaws.
I think his lawyer argues it was hard to find on the internet.
If you type NFL Constitution into Google, it is the first search that comes up. But again, I'm happy to sort of rest on the fact that there was no request here and that he affirmatively represented that he had read it. The version that was introduced indicated on its face that it had not been amended. And with regard to the conduct detrimental determination, it's enough. The commissioner, by moving to compel arbitration, had made that determination. And at a minimum, he could make it in the arbitration as a delegated issue. With my remaining 10 seconds on the issue of procedural unconscionability, all that I would say is that Chief Justice Kadish was exactly correct. The mere fact that something is a contract of adhesion is not enough. And here, what we're really talking about is a single term that, in Mr. Hosmer-Henner's view, the Raiders would not have negotiated away. No surprise there, because the incorporation of the Constitution is central. It contains the rules of the game. And it's faintly preposterous to suggest that a longtime coach who is represented by a savvy agent should not be held to those terms, including the arbitration provision. We would submit that the district court's orders should be reversed. Thank you.
Thank you. All right. All right. Thanks, counsel, for your briefs and your arguments. This matter will stand submitted and will be at ease for a few minutes while we reset for our next argument. All right, then. Next case is 85569 Adkins versus Union Pacific Railroad et al. Counsel, are you ready to proceed?
Yes, sir.
Okay. Mr. Henriad, did you want to reserve any time for rebuttal?
Yes, please, Your Honor. 4 minutes.
Okay, as you well know, at 4 minutes, you'll get the yellow light and a tone, but the clock keeps running. Go ahead.
I may have pleased the court, Joel Henriot, on behalf of the 147 plaintiff appellants. The district court erred in dismissing these claims as untimely under the statute of limitations. First, the common law discovery rule is incorporated in NRS 11194E, and each of these plaintiffs brought their claims within 2 years of discovering that they existed, that they had actionable claims. And alternatively, at very least, the statute of limitations is equitably told. They adequately raised that issue, and importantly, they made a substantive showing. On the statutory construction issue, let me point out that this is a construction question. This is not a case where there's a plain reading on one side and then just an appeal to public policy on the other. The language of the statute is sparse, and so it does require some interpretation. It just says that the 2-year period applies to an action to recover damages for injuries to a person or for the death of a person caused by the wrongful act of another, and that that limitation applies to causes of action that accrue after March 20, 1951. But it doesn't define accrual.
How do you square that with the fact that there are other subsections that do include specific discovery rule language?
Mm-hmm. A number of those have been added to the chapter, to Chapter 11, after this 1951 version, although there were a few provisions within even the 1951 version that had the statutory discovery rule included. But the surplusage canon is not dispositive here because, and even Justice Scalia and Mr. Gardner would point out that it is not dispositive because legislatures often do repeat themselves. They do give emphasis to particular points occasionally out of a belt and suspenders approach or to err on the side of caution. But it's not dispositive. It has to be weighed against the other canons. Here, a very important canon of construction is the prior construction canon. When a statute, especially if it has been amended after the jurisdiction's highest court has interpreted language used in that statute or in related statutes, then this court's prior interpretations go to the statutory construction in this case. And here, that is very important. I mean, we set out, and the amicus sets out, the long history of the common law discovery rule and its use in interpreting the statutes of limitation. It goes back 45 years, 1978, to Sorensen. We set all of those out, not just to remind the court of the weight of history and the stakes, but also because they are relevant to how the court interprets, how it construes this statute now. Because once the court has interpreted accrual, as it has, once it applies the common law discovery rule to this statute of limitations and others in the same scheme in Chapter 11, that is deemed to apply to this statute as a matter of statutory construction, especially where it's been amended.
To the extent you're relying on Peterson, which was the sexual assault case, they did amend the statute and created a specific statute for sexual assault after that split decision was handed down. And I think that's one of the most significant authorities that you're relying on. And then they added in the except as provided in 11215 to make sure that the reader of 194E got the message. That they fixed the Peterson problem in their estimation. So isn't the legislative history a bit of a wash there?
So I don't think so. Here's why. I think that Peterson shows that it was the common understanding of the court that the common law discovery rule would apply to the statute. The majority thought so. Concurring Justice Rose thought so. Justice Stephan didn't disagree with that.
But he went further and just said it doesn't apply. And well, called on the legislature to do something in this setting, which was sexual assault.
Well, he agreed that it would be problematic to rely on that, not that it didn't apply. I think more important for this court's analysis is actually Sorenson versus Pavlikowski, or Oak Grove Investors versus Bell and Gossett, or Soper versus Means, Bemis versus Estate of Bemis. Because in all four of those cases, this court applied the common law discovery doctrine to statutes of limitation that were silent as to the moment of accrual and did not include that express language.
Is there any difference between when a cause of action accrues and for tort, you need an injury, and the discovery rule? It seems to me there is, but the briefs are going back and forth without really distinguishing between the two.
So as we set out, we address it in the opening brief, and then we come back around to it in the reply brief with the citation to Massey versus Litton. You have to have not just a physical injury, it has to be a legal injury. It has to be actionable, which includes knowledge of the elements to meet the claim. In a toxic tort, it's a little bit different.
Yeah, and that strikes me that, but in this case, you're saying the people, the complaint detail in great detail alleges that when the people went into the building in 95, they were getting sick and they saw soot everywhere. I understand that doesn't necessarily deal with all the each individual plaintiff that you have, but it stops short of the theory of the complaint that you need to have the medical doctor's opinion that it was this soot and this caused these injuries for this medical reason. I mean, people were getting sick and they thought the soot in the building had something to do with it.
So a few were, and I think this really is an unfair extrapolation from a few points in the complaint. I think that those are primarily important, because they provide data points for an epidemiological opinion. One of the big differences between a toxic tort and just an ordinary impact tort, right, is the question of general causation. And you have to know that there is some causal link between the exposure that you've had and the disease that you have. Once that cluster, and this is the kind of analysis that epidemiologically can only be seen in the aggregate, and then once you see the cluster, then to draw the timeline, you can go and look at some of these facts. When did people start getting sick? When were their complaints? Here we had a few who were working in the basement where it was really unnerving how dirty it was. That is important to draw the timeline, but it only becomes relevant and actionable when you can link it to some disease that you have, because an expert has seen the cluster and has established that general causation component. Really, that is what puts people on inquiry notice in toxic tort cases. If you have mesothelioma, because if the general causation has been established, you know if you have that disease to start wondering when you might have been exposed to asbestos. If you have cancer and you watch a commercial, why, yes, I was at Camp Lejeune and did drink a lot of water, then you are on notice that somebody has drawn that general causation nexus. Here, nobody had knowledge that had been established until 2 years before this complaint. The facts in the complaint then are anecdotal. And what they do is they are relevant to drawing that timeline. Did we raise it? Yes, we raised equitable tolling. We raised it in the oppositions to the motions to dismiss, albeit not at length, but we did raise the doctrine. We cited to Fausto, and in particular, we also made, especially I would say, we also made a substantive showing that it applies because the factors under equitable tolling overlap with the showing for the discovery rule.
But it, is equitable tolling, like some courts elsewhere have used equitable tolling to deal with the toxic tort latency problem because people don't know that they are sick even though they had an exposure because it hasn't manifested itself. Is that a narrower exception than the discovery rule?
I think, yes, it is narrower. I don't think the showing is narrower. I think that it is, it, in those cases where it applies just the same. So in this case, if NRS 11194E does incorporate that, the common law discovery rule, then I think the showing is the same as would be necessary for equitable tolling. I think equitable tolling wouldn't apply in every case, but it does in this one. The showing is the same that we made. It reminds me of Western Technologies, Inc. versus All American. It was an offset case. The offset was raised post-judgment. It was denied in the district court because the defendant raised the Contribution Among Joint Tortfeasors Act, and it was a contract case. This court reversed and said an offset is an offset, even though the Contribution Among Joint Tortfeasors Act doesn't apply, the Uniform Joint Obligations Act does. So you've made the same showing. Here, it was reasonable for counsel to have focused as much as they did on the discovery rule per se. I mean, if this course were to reverse course after 45 years, and you know, respectfully, we think you shouldn't. This statute has been amended 18 times since Sorenson, and the legislature has never expressed any concern with application of the discovery rule. But if you were to do that, in fairness, I think it would be appropriate to notice that this would be a change in the law, at least a change in the bar's understanding. All of those cases.
You're saying if we didn't apply the discovery rule,
right,
it would be a change in the
right.
law?
Right. If you didn't apply that, it would be a change in the law. I think all of those cases from Sorenson through Bemis, as most recently as the unpublished Crab case, demonstrate that it is a very common understanding in the bar that the common law rule is applicable to this statutory provision. And if it's not, it was reasonable to believe it was, and to emphasize the points and authorities as demonstrating that the substantive showing is the same as would be necessary under the equitable tolling doctrine. I'll reserve the rest of my time. Thank you.
Thank you. Counsel?
May it please the court, Ray Hartman of Perkins Coie LLP for CalNev Pipeline and the Kinder Morgan defendants speaking on behalf of the respondents. This court has a long history of deference to the legislature on policy choices and faithfulness to the statutes enacted by the legislature. This court has said that its role is to declare what the law is, not to create the law. That is what defendants seek here. For the court to apply the clear and unambiguous statute that governs this dispute and to leave the legislating to the legislature. We completely disagree that, first of all, that the plain language is somehow murky or ambiguous here. There are several provisions in 11190 that include discovery rule language. 4E is not one of them. There is nothing ambiguous about the absence 4E, and under Nevada law, the court should construe that as an intentional omission and not an accidental omission.
Counsel, wouldn't that allow for the possibility that someone could have blown the statute of limitations and be unable to sue before they even know that they have an injury?
No, I don't think that's the case, Your Honor. As part of the accrual analysis, the claim is not complete until there's an injury. So there's much said in the brief, some alarmist kind of doomsday scenarios where you can't get divorced before you're married. You can't lose your claim before you have one. You cannot lose your claim before you have one.
But isn't causation part of the claim?
Causation is part of the claim, Your Honor, but the idea
so
that
if you're sick, but you have no idea that it's actually connected to your workplace.
You're on inquiry notice at that point, Your Honor,
because you're sick?
Because you have an illness. But particularly here, I think we can look at the facts, right? While a plaintiff is entitled to deference on the facts that it pleads in its complaint, it's also somewhat stuck with them. We have a lot of facts laid out in paragraphs 202.
Part of the facts here, at least alleged in the complaint, that when people made inquiry, they were rebuffed by the county and told, no, there's nothing wrong, it's fine, just keep going, you know, keep working. It seems to suggest that none of these conditions were disclosed by the people who actually knew about them.
But that's not the test for what a rational potential plaintiff or an injured party would do with the information that my coworkers are getting sick. There's black soot on my desk, where the First Amendment complaint also alleges that they made these inquiries. At that point, if your employer says, oh, everything's fine, which there's no evidence that that's what took place here, but even so, a plaintiff wouldn't be permitted to just rest and sit until 25 years later when doctors and lawyers come together and investigate the situation. They're on inquiry notice at that point to figure out what happened to them, right? That's the whole point of the statute of limitations.
So I apologize, sure. But this was resolved on a motion to dismiss, on a NRCP 12B5 motion to dismiss. We have a long list of plaintiffs in this case. How do we know from the face of the complaint that each of those listed plaintiffs was on inquiry notice more than 2 years before this case was filed?
So I think it's important there, Your Honor, to look at the strategy employed by the plaintiffs here. Through the original complaint, the amended complaint, the opposition to the motion to dismiss, both briefs before this court and today, you're not going to hear, and you haven't heard, that a single one of those plaintiffs has a particular date that they became ill.
Because all we're looking at is the face of the complaint.
But that's not the theory. The theory is very clear in the complaint and the briefing. Discovery is not when they got hurt in this case or when they experienced an illness. Discovery is tied not to plaintiff's conditions at all. It's tied to when the plaintiff's lawyers and the doctors did their investigation and came up with the idea that this is where the injury is coming from. So this goes to the question of whether there's any need to do any discovery. The answer is no.
Please. But you would agree that in a case of a latent tort where you have exposure to something that is incredibly injurious, but it doesn't manifest itself for 20 years, that plaintiff isn't required to sue before she knows she has a claim.
That's correct, and I think that's the state of the law today. Yeah. We're not asking
whether you call it accrual or by the terms of the statute or discovery, or you get there on equitable estoppel, right?
Right, it's the last element of the claim, and therefore that's the element that would trigger the
and
statute.
And so these plaintiffs, we have a group of 50 plaintiffs, and I understand that they wanted to saddle and ride the horse that it was when their lawyer and the doctor got together, and that applies to all of them. But even if you say that's not so because they had manifest injury and inquiry notice and all the rest of it, we still can't count them out on the face of that complaint as not having claims, can we?
I think we can count them out because the strategy was to not go that route. This is the only horse to extend your analogy, the only horse they're riding. They've had ample opportunity to present any one plaintiff that for which there's a date of injury that would save that plaintiff, but that's not what they're doing.
In the context of 12b-5, I mean, it's a notice pleading state. I get that the complaint is really long and elaborate, but it strikes me that there could be plaintiffs to whom that's a fair comment. I mean, that they didn't know.
So, Your Honor, I'd also encourage the court to look at the history of this case, which is on this point. That issue was not raised at the district court level. Again,
what issue? The standard under the rule wasn't raised?
No, that we should look at the individual plaintiffs to determine whether the individual plaintiffs meet the statute of limitations, because that's not the argument here. I would submit, Your Honor, that this is a new rule that they're trying to get through, which is that the discovery here, the accrual, can be based on the study by the plaintiff's lawyers and the doctors. It's clear in there, the only discovery rule argument they are pinning their arguments to is the study by the lawyers and the doctors. So
counsel, so I'm reading on page 27 of the complaint, the paragraph entitled discovery rule. It says in the middle of it, plaintiffs will show that after reasonably exercising due diligence, plaintiffs and decedents did not learn the nature of the cause of plaintiffs' decedents' cancers and illnesses, or that such cancers or illnesses were chemically related until less than 2 years prior to the filing of plaintiffs' decedents' causes of action herein. Doesn't that do it?
No, it doesn't do it, Your Honor. Especially, Your Honor, if you look at the arguments in the full context of the briefing, that could, if in that process they're saying, look, here are the plaintiffs, and each of them found this out at this time, and therefore they are saved by the discovery rule, that would be one thing.
That's what they alleged, right there.
But the arguments are clear that they're pinning that not to any individual's injury or date of illness, but to these studies. And so they're
saying that's when they learned that they were chemically related and the nature of the cause of them.
That's correct. That's the argument. But I think that's similar to Fausto, Your Honor, which I was going to get to anyway with equitable tolling. So in Fausto, of course, the elements of equitable tolling are laid out. And I think this case is analogous. And the Fausto case requires the same result here. So in Fausto, of course, there was a two-week delay, not a two-decade delay, which I think undercuts the diligence argument. But more importantly, there was a reliance on waiting for a rape kit to say whether there was evidence of the assault. And the court correctly said, no, you knew the facts. The facts put you on inquiry notice. So you're on inquiry notice here when you see your coworkers becoming ill, when you see soot on your desk, and when it's widely known so much that there are complaints, even if they're rebuffed, that there's an environmental problem here. That's inquiry notice when you get sick, not before you get sick, but when you get sick, you're on inquiry notice to inquire, to go to a doctor, your own doctor, and figure out.
But this isn't like a bunch of people got into a car accident, right? You have people with different kinds of cancer. Why would you expect that they would necessarily make that connection if people are becoming sick with different sorts of ailments?
Well, I think that the idea that it's coming from the building, right, is right in the first amended complaint. It's potentially concerning that it's coming from the building. Right? And those plaintiffs, whether it's one manifestation of a disease or another, those people are, if you get sick, you're on notice that, especially under the environment that I'm working in, coworkers are getting sick, there's these environmental conditions in the building, that's inquiry notice.
But even if we credit your position that you don't have to have the doctor and the lawyer get together and determine exactly what the cause is, but that there is some inquiry notice going on here. The complaint, I can't read it to say that one of these plaintiffs is not someone who went to work 2 years before they filed suit and got sick within 2 years after.
It also doesn't say it is, right?
Right,
right, and I think that it's clarified by the briefing. It's very clear in the briefing that they're only riding this one horse again, to extend your analogy. There's no other, they haven't pointed to a single plaintiff who would be saved by the discovery rule other than when the lawyers and doctors got together. And there's also no justification for why lawyers and doctors didn't get together when people started getting sick in 1995, or the inquiry wasn't in 2000 or 2010. I would submit that under the plaintiff's theory that they could have waited till 2030, 2020, or 2040. And here's another thing, Your Honor.
Your point is Fausto was decided on 12b-5, and
right,
this case was too, and you ought to hold it to that.
I think Fausto is
Fausto was a single plaintiff case.
That's right, and I think that underscores the problem.
And she knew she had been raped by someone she actually knew.
And
so I don't see how.
Well, this goes back to the inquiry notice, Your Honor. The claim doesn't accrue until you become ill or you're injured in this context, car accidents aside. So you know that you're sick.
And so as soon as you're sick, on inquiry notice that it was caused by your workplace.
Under the facts pled in this first amended complaint, multiple people getting sick, potentially dozens of people. There's 150 plaintiffs, right? The environmental issues, as pled in this complaint, the black soot going to your superiors, that is inquiry notice. And, Your Honor, there's...
we don't need to decide the discovery rule issue in this case, is your position?
So my position is that the discovery rule doesn't apply, but even if it did, they were on inquiry notice long before the 2 years. Even if the court were to apply the discovery rule, which I think...
And even though we don't know when these individual plaintiffs went to work there, you're saying, in effect, their lawyers conceded the point that they were all more than 2 years prior.
They absolutely conceded the point. And it's in the reply brief. The only argument for saving any of the plaintiffs is the discovery rule through the doctor's and the lawyer's investigation. There's no other argument. Now, of course, they want to go back to the district court and do a discovery there, which was not requested at the district court level, so it was waived. But I think the briefing is clear. This is the only one.
I mean, that would be the effect of a denial of a motion to dismiss, right? I mean, this isn't like a summary judgment motion where you have to move to do additional discovery. If you're defending a motion to dismiss and saying, judge, you shouldn't dismiss it, the implication is the case would proceed and there would be discovery, right?
No, I think the argument would be, judge, you shouldn't dismiss this. You should allow us to show you do an individualized inquiry and show you that the discovery rule does apply.
If you have to do discovery, the motion to dismiss should be denied.
Denied, right. But that argument wasn't made. That's the point. That argument wasn't made at all there. So now that there's several instances, including equitable tolling, that was not raised at the district court level, and now they want to go back to the district court and have a second bite at those arguments.
I just want to go back because I found the specific place in the complaint. It says, consistently, Clark County workers were told by county supervisors that there were no problems with the building or the property. So how is it reasonable if somebody's being told by their employer, yeah, I know you're sick, well, you've got a bunch of people getting sick, but it's not from the building, why would they be on inquiry notice?
Shouldn't
they be able to trust their employer to tell them?
For an environmental, I would say no. I would say once you get ill, you would be talking to your own doctors as to what could be the causes of your illness. And I think we would look at that for individual plaintiffs as well, right? But and to be clear, the doctors that were were part of the investigation here were not the treating doctors. I'm sorry, Your Honor, I just wanted to answer that.
No, it's okay. I appreciate that. And I think Justice Pickering has another question. So
yeah, estimation is the difference between equitable estoppel and the discovery rule?
Right. They are different, right? They're obviously related concepts. The requirements for equitable tolling are laid out in Fausto. Obviously I don't believe that they were satisfied here, but they are different concepts. And you can have, and I think this comes up if you look at both Peterson and Fausto. You can have no discovery rule and still have equitable tolling, right? We're not arguing that there's no concept of equitable tolling. We don't think
so. Do you concede that there's equitable tolling that could theoretically apply on a toxic tort take?
The concept of equitable tolling is available here. On the facts pled in the FA in the first amended complaint, there's, I don't believe, any way to reach an equitable tolling argument given the lapse of time. And the application of Fausto, it will also lead to that same conclusion, Your Honor. And I think there was an incorrect statement about the holding in Peterson. I don't think Peterson found a discovery rule here. Okay. I think Peterson said that only the two-year statute of limitations applies, but there's no discovery. There's no statute of limitations that applies when you're talking about a minor victim of child sex abuse. Unless the court has any other questions. Thank you, Your Honors.
All right. Let's add another 2 minutes.
Thank you.
Okay, go ahead.
It is a notice pleading state. At the motion to dismiss stage, we certainly argued that the analysis would need to be individual, and we criticized defendants for improperly extrapolating the anecdotes of a few to the entire group.
Do you have a page cite for that?
I'll see if we can find one. We certainly criticized the extrapolation. I think at very least, right, that connotes that it is an individual issue.
So and after the argument that's is done, if you can get us a cite, that would be great.
And then as to accrual, Fausto, right. In Fausto, the plaintiff knew she had been attacked. She knew who it was. She didn't have the type of evidence that she would have preferred, but she had legally enough evidence to go forward. Here, there was no connection that any of these people had, again, at that general causation level, to draw a link.
Would you agree? Even under the discovery rule, the plaintiff doesn't need to have firm evidence establishing the causation. There just needs to be enough to place them on inquiry notice. Those aren't necessarily the same thing, right?
Not necessarily, right? Because you can develop facts over the course of the litigation. But to have some scientist somewhere establishing a link is necessary in toxic tort cases. The vast majority of these people weren't working in the basement. They weren't the people who were unnerved by this soot that they saw. So what, anybody working anywhere in the building who gets cancer is supposed to sue because they knew that one of their coworkers a decade ago was concerned about soot? That is absurd. When doctors and lawyers get together, that is how every toxic tort case starts. Because what you have to happen again is somebody doing the investigation work from an epidemiological standpoint to draw that nexus. And then you get to individuals as to whether or not they can show specific causation as well. But that's always a necessary spot. And until you have that general causation, you don't have an actionable claim, which means you don't have a legal injury. If you're going to look at the legislature and leave it to them, the court can't disregard the prior construction statute. And since Sorensen, 1190 has been amended 16 times, Oak Grove 14 times, since Peterson 12 times, since Bemis 9 times. The legislature has revisited the statute again and again with the backdrop of that case law. Thank you.
Thank you. Appreciate the briefing.